welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 20th of December 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. We have a week to go until Christmas Day, and it's right at the beginning of Christmas week, and it's the same as every other week for us here at Radio Albion, which means that we are here today to discuss the week's news and to get into our greatest Britons. And my co-host for that, as always, is Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. Are you in a Christmas spirit? Are you in a festive mood?
I'm starting to get a bit more festive now. I'm always like a last minute Christmas shopper, and so I've now got into my stride when it comes to Christmas shopping. So I think I'm starting to look forward to the festive period, and hopefully it will be a good Christmas, and hopefully the Conservatives won't spoil it with any kind of lockdowns resulting from Omicron.
Yeah, well, that's the issue, isn't it? They're saying that there are less people that are going out, nightclubs are down. They're talking about bringing in restrictions. They're definitely talking about bringing in restrictions in Wales, I think, and in Northern Ireland. They already have in Holland, I believe. They've locked everyone down in Holland. There's talk of this all over Europe. And yet, as I did a programme last week on the Daily Nationalist looking at this Omicron in South Africa, it's much milder than previous diseases. I mean, it would be of benefit for more people to catch this Omicron and build up an immunity system against it. We've been told we've had one person that's died. We don't know if they died with it or from it. And yet they're still talking about doing all these lockdowns. And there's lots of pushback against it. I don't think the general public want to have another lockdown, but of course the mainstream media are saying that the public do. I know you've been looking at some of the figures, Max, to do with this Omicron and last year. What do they say?
Yeah, there was an article I saw today on the internet in which a GP was quoted, and what he was saying there is that although the number of cases this year is on the increase, there haven't been because we've been so many of our people have been vaccinated now, that there hasn't been a rise in admissions. And he was comparing last year with this year, and was saying that in the same week last year there were 19,000 people hospitalized with COVID, whereas this year in this week there are only 7,600, so it's less than half. And he was saying that this week last year there were 2,000 people being diagnosed and admitted to hospital each day, whereas this year it's only 900. The figure that doesn't seem to be being quoted, though, is the number of deaths, because what's happened is that we had Boris Johnson on television sort of 4 or 5 days ago announcing that we've had the very first death from the Omicron variant of COVID. And since then, there's been absolute silence on how many of the people that are dying of the Omicron variant. And in view of the fact that there have been quite a few reports from South Africa that deaths in South Africa have topped out and are starting to decline now. And the reports have also said that the experience of people in South Africa is that the Omicron variant is less severe than the earlier variants of COVID. You know, one would expect that the number of deaths from Omicron will be proportionately less than the older variants. And so, but that doesn't the proof of that seems to be, or you know, the proof or otherwise of that seems to be hidden from us at the moment. It appears that the government and the National Health Service don't want people to be able to differentiate between those people dying with COVID and those people dying with Omicron. And I think it would be interesting if somebody would publish those figures. And I think it's kind of suspicious that nobody is publishing those figures, because it kind of suggests to me that perhaps the numbers of people dying from Omicron are very, very low, and that
They're trying to scare people, aren't they? They're trying to scare people. I mean, I've had people that aren't, you know, vaccine skeptics or skeptical of COVID or anything like that. And they've been saying to me, it's very strange because all the news is just filled up with COVID and trying to terrify everyone about this new variant. And, you know, we've been vaccinated. We were told that we were going to be able to get back to normal. And, you know, why are they doing this? What's the difference with this? And you look into it and, you know, one person has died of it. Well, they are saying that it's doubling, Max. They're saying that, you know, the people that are catching it, it's doubling every day. And that's what their fear is. And the hospitals might be overwhelmed. But that wasn't the case in South Africa. Why would it be the case here?
And it does, based upon those figures in that article by that GP, that doesn't appear to be borne out by the number of hospitalizations being half this year what they were in the same week last year. It just doesn't seem to make sense. And it's interesting that an anagram of the word Omicron is moronic, which I thought was quite amusing when I heard that.
Yeah, I mean, well, and also the vaccine, their response to it. Because at first they were saying, well, we don't know if the vaccines are going to help. And now they're saying, well, you've got to have a booster. You've got to boost the boosters. And I think everybody's already been boosted. They've had three. So now they're saying you've got to have four injections in order to beat this variant. And I was thinking, well, what about those who are vax-free then? Those who haven't been vaccinated at all? Have they got to now have four injections? So have we got to have four injections now before we have any resistance to this virus? I mean, that seems absolutely ludicrous when we were told that you would just need one and then you would need two. I mean, are these vaccines efficacious in any way whatsoever if you have to have four of them? And wouldn't it be better just to have people to build up an immunity to this? If it's milder, then why do you need four injections before you can beat it, if it's milder? It doesn't make sense. And it doesn't seem as if it's just us that are asking these questions either, because there seems to have been quite a rebellion amongst the Conservatives about this. At least 100 of them voted against Boris's recommendations for this, which was basically going back to stage three, I think it was. If you remember in the summer, there were four stages, weren't there? And in stage four, we finally lifted everything in July, and you could have as many people as you wanted at a gathering. You could go out and there weren't any restrictions. But before that, it was something like you could only have up to 30 people anywhere. And this is what they brought in again. And the pubs are being told that you have to serve people outside and no more than six people. All these ridiculous rules and regulations that people don't know how to keep, can't remember all of them. And the Conservatives have rebelled against it, but only 100 of them. And what are the Labour Party doing? They're supposed to be the opposition. They're supposed to be the ones that are calling this out and suggesting doing other things. And they're just backing Boris Johnson. What do you make of the Tory rebellion, Max?
Well, I think that it's very understandable. I think if you look at the effect that lockdowns and this Plan B, I think Boris is referring it to, that's now been introduced against the wishes of those 100 Conservative MPs. But you know, the effect of this Plan B is that there have been lots of seasonal events that have been cancelled now. And that's going to have a knock-on effect with people working from home. That's going to have a knock-on effect. And the knock-on effect is going to be that it's going to further damage business, that it's going to prevent us rising up out of the recession that's been caused as a result of the pandemic. And, you know, with interest rates rising, or not interest rates, with inflation rising rather, there's going to be calls for interest rates to be put up, which will then dampen public spending, which will then mean that, again, that will reduce the amount of business being done, and that will tend to reduce the gross national product. And so we could end up in a kind of stagflation kind of situation, which was a thing of that we, you know, I think we've all started to think of as a thing of the past, where you've got both high inflation and economic stagnation at the same time. And so things aren't looking too good at the moment. And it appears that Boris Johnson is staggering from one crisis to another. No sooner has he absorbed one body blow than another body blow comes along, and his popularity is declining very rapidly. And this is obviously what is worrying a lot of the Conservative MPs. You know, we had the Shropshire by-election just recently, where there was an almost cataclysmic drop in the vote for the Conservatives, where their vote in 2019 was 35,444. It fell to 12,032. So they lost 2/3 of their electoral support in that election. And that's all as a result of the sort of bumbling that's going on at the moment, the uncertainty, the fact that there have been, you know, admissions about Christmas parties last year, and the response by Boris Johnson has been weak in terms of getting to the bottom of whether these alleged parties actually did take place and whether they were actually in breach of the COVID rules for last year. But the fact of the matter is that whether they turn out to actually technically be inside the COVID rules for last year, the damage has already been done, in that public confidence in the government has now been knocked, you know, very massively. And so we're in a situation where we've got a very weak Conservative government that's reeling, and it's on the ropes, really, and receiving body blow after body blow, as I said earlier on. And at the same time, we've got nobody really of any substance who can step into the breach and say, you know, turn to me, because I've got the clear vision. I can see the way out of this, because none of the main political parties have got any kind of a clear vision whatsoever. They all, and as you say, the Labour Party have been supporting the Conservative government in getting Plan B passed in Parliament. And so it appears that Keir Starmer has got no more of an idea of what to do than Boris does. And even if we did have a general election and Boris was replaced by Keir Starmer, then we'd just get more of the same. If there was a Conservative leadership election and Boris was replaced with somebody else, well, unless it's somebody like Lord Frost, who's got a markedly different point of view, then it would again just be more of the same. And that's another, you know, one of the body blows that's hit Boris, the fact that Lord Frost has resigned. Lord Frost, if anybody that doesn't know, is the person who's been negotiating the finer details of our withdrawal from the European Union, and has been making representations to the European Union about the Northern Ireland Protocol. And it's well known that he's had a number of quite significant differences of opinion with regard to how the agreement with the European Union should be eventually sorted out. He wants us to no longer be subservient to the European courts, and he also wants us to be able to invoke, I think it's Article 16, I think that's what it's called, which is the part of the Northern Ireland Protocol that will enable us to suspend the Northern Ireland Protocol if there is a significant difference between the British government and the European Union over the way in which it should be implemented. And so because of differences there between Lord Frost and the government, Lord Frost has resigned. And he was has been such a strong man amidst other people who've been vacillating and basically directionless, that the loss of him in the government is a massive body blow, I think.
Well, he was also against the COVID regulations. Apparently, when he left, it was in a flurry of criticisms of COVID regulations. And it's really, really apparently let Boris down. Just to add on what you were saying there as well, Max, apparently inflation is running at 5%, which is very high. But of course, the government say, oh yes, but we've got very good unemployment figures. We've managed to get lots of people back to work. But what's the good of that if they're going to shut things down again, and people are going to lose their businesses. I mean, people are right on the edge. The shops are right on their edge. And it does seem that people are turning against the Tories. When you think about the massive win that they had when Boris got voted in, and they managed to collapse the Red Wall in the north, for him to then lose in this safe seat in Shropshire, which has been a Conservative Party seat, I think, ever since the Conservative Party began. And you can look at that and you can say, well, perhaps it's an individual thing. This Owen Paterson, everybody was very upset with Owen Paterson and the sleaze allegations. Perhaps they're just looking to punish the Conservative Party. But this Helen Morgan from the Liberal Democrats that won, I mean, she won by quite a large margin. I mean, this should be very worrying for the Conservative Party. But again, it's not going to be worrying for the establishment, because they don't mind who they have in. They don't mind if it's the Conservatives or if it's the Labour Party, because they're still going to do the bidding of the establishment, aren't they? They're still going to carry on with the lockdowns, as we know, because there's been no pushback from Keir Starmer on that. They're still going to carry on with the Great Reset that we see all the Western leaders talking about, which comes to them directly from the World Economic Forum and comes directly from Klaus Schwab. They're still going to be pushing ahead with this stakeholder capitalism idea, where governments are just another stakeholder and the other stakeholders are NGOs and corporations. And of course, the finance, which actually runs these corporations, and the corporations run the NGOs, they're going to be the ones that are deciding everything. And on the NHS as well, I think that's going to be a stakeholder in this. And the government is just one of many stakeholders in this new idea for capitalism. There's nobody standing against that. All the leaders of the Western world, they're all pushing for this. They're all united on this. It's almost like they're being given a script to follow. You know, you can really see that when they all come out talking about the Great Reset and Build Back Better. You know, it's not just Boris that talks about this. So, I mean, even if the Tories are concerned that they might get taken down, the establishment is not going to be bothered by it at all. We've got nobody that's actually pushing back against this. Well, we have one person that is pushing back against it. We have Piers Corbyn, in actual fact, who is apparently in a little spot of bother for calling for people to burn down MPs' offices, allegedly. This happened over the weekend. I mean, some pretty fruity stuff that he was actually saying. Apparently, he was urging a crowd to hammer to death those scum who have decided to go ahead with introducing new fascism. He appears to tell a crowd in a video, and then he says, you've got to get a list of them, and if your MP is one of them, go to their offices, and well, I would recommend burning them down. Okay, but I can't say that on air. I hope we're not on air. I mean, that is a direct incitement there that Piers Corbyn is engaging in to burn down MPs' houses. Of course, he's of an age where he thought he'd be able to say things like this, because the general population aren't going to be stupid enough to take what he says literally. I should imagine he's expecting people to just take this as, well, this is how upset we are with the government. Obviously, don't do anything so stupid as this, but this is how upset we are with them. I can't believe that he was genuinely inciting people to go and burn down these houses. But this is the only sort of resistance that we have against this. It's people that have a reputation for being crazies. You know, we don't have anybody over here in Britain who's really respected that's sort of leading the anti-COVID lockdown movement. We don't have any nationalist organisations. The BNP have been taken down. All we're left with is community-based organisation like Patriotic Alternative, and they're still trying to stop Patriotic Alternative from actually becoming a proper political party. It's like they've got it all sewn up so that we can't resist. The only way you can really resist is just to not get vaccinated, really. And that way, I guess, you know, and that's what matters. At least then you haven't been genetically modified. I mean, there's lots of stuff there for you to comment on, Max. What do you think of this arrest of Piers Corbyn?
Well, I think if what he said is true, then you know he's playing a very dangerous game there, and really running the risk of being prosecuted for possibly even for a breach of the Terrorism Act. But hopefully he didn't say that, and hopefully he didn't really mean it. But following on from what you said about the lack of leadership, yeah, I mean, we've seen Nigel Farage treading around the margins of British politics for a little while now, and that there is this new party that I think he is to some extent linked with, and I seem to remember seeing an article recently where he was having a meeting with a past Tory donor, and the report sort of indicated that he was trying to get that Tory donor to switch their allegiance to the party that he now supports. But Nigel Farage, who possibly became Britain's most popular politician at one point in recent times, and certainly when he was the leader of UKIP, and UKIP won that European election as far as Britain is concerned, and had so many Euro MPs elected. And if that could have been translated into MPs in Westminster, that would have been a tremendous step forward for politics in this country. But unfortunately, Nigel Farage seems to have a habit of just when he's on the cusp of achieving everything he's always wanted to achieve, of deciding that he wants to resign from politics and go back to looking after his family and his personal affairs, and then makes a comeback. And of course, you can only resign and declare that you're going to retire. You can only do that so many times before people stop taking you seriously. And I'm afraid he might be in danger of falling into that trap.
He's really squandered all that political capital that he had. I'm wondering whether if the party that you were mentioning there that he was in talks with, whether that was the Reclaim Party. Lawrence Fox has started up a party that is supposed to be anti-political correctness and anti the COVID lockdown, but he really didn't get much support for that when he stood on that platform for Mayor of London, I think. Peter Rushton has pointed out that these parties that are sort of standing on an anti-COVID platform and supporting that throughout Europe, they really haven't done very well in the polls. I mean, there may be a lot of people that go out and say, well, we don't want lockdowns. We reject, a lot of this stuff that we've been told we have to do because of COVID. But then they don't actually support any of the politicians that are talking about that, because I guess they're sort of one platform people. And I know Patriotic Alternative are sort of leaning towards the COVID skeptics and protesting against vaccination, but then they have a full platform behind that as well. And I'm not sure this Lawrence Fox whether he has much, apart from he's against political correctness and COVID-19. And yeah, Nigel Farage, I believe what he's doing now is taking money to read things out or something like that. And he's also a presenter on GB News, because we have GB News now, which is our official alternative outlet that we're all supposed to go along with. And I was listening to a podcast the other day, and this chap was being interviewed by GB News, and he had a whiteboard up there with all the things he wanted to talk about. And they said, no, you can't talk about any of those. And he sort of scrubbed the whiteboard clean. So it's a limited outlet, GB News at best, sort of gatekeeping style. Well, we got to think of something positive to end our roundup of the news here, Max. Well, at least England hasn't gone for the measures that Scotland has gone for, or Wales has gone for, but they might well do in the new year. And at least we're not forced vaccinating people like Austria and Germany. I mean, that must be absolutely terrible. If you're not vaccinated there, then you run the risk of huge fines. And if you still don't go and get vaccinated, you run the risk of being sent to prison. I mean, that is scandalous. And Boris Johnson has said, well, maybe we need to have a talk about this. And Sajid Javid has said, well, I don't think we'll be doing that. But it's not like they've actually put that off the table. But at least we haven't gone that far. And at least we're not as bad as in Australia, where they're locking people up in COVID camps, aren't they? Quarantine COVID camps.
It's almost like treating people like sheep, where the stray sheep is dragged and slung into the sheep dip after it resisted sort of going into it. And you will go through the sheep dip, or else you'll be forced to go through the sheep dip. You know, that kind of an approach just doesn't bode well, really. What we find is that slowly, bit by bit, governments in both this country and the rest of Europe are slipping into the habits of the totalitarian regimes around the world that we're supposedly opposed to in terms of their methods. And you have to wonder how long before more police state kind of interventions are made, because as we've just been discussing, there isn't really anybody with the authorities to resist that sort of thing if the government wants to press ahead and introduce them.
Yeah, they really don't want to give up any of these special powers that they've given themselves during these COVID times. But I do think there could be some hope on the horizon. This Omicron variant, it may be much, much milder. I mean, that's the wording that this South African doctor actually said, very, very much milder than the Delta variant. And because of that, you could end up with, and also it's very infectious as well, but very much milder. So you could end up with a lot of people being immune to it, which is what we want. We want the virus to get so mild that it just becomes like a common cold. And then people don't get hospitalized and people don't die from it. And then they'll have to think of some other excuse to keep us locked up. Well, shall we go back in time and talk about more positive days for Britain, Max, in our greatest Britons, do you think?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's get into our final installment of Captain Scott's Terra Nova expedition. And I have to begin with a correction. Last week, I said the Aurora Borealis, when the notes I had in front of me just said Aurora. And I should have said Aurora Australis, as these were the southern lights that Captain Scott was talking about, and not the northern lights that we see in Europe. And you were telling me this, Max, and you were telling me that there's also words for east and west. I knew Occident. Yeah, Occident and Oriental. So that's north, south, east and west, is it?
Yes, that's my understanding of things. So that the Orient is the east. Occident is the west, and Borealis just means northern. I'm not quite sure what the equivalent of just north would be, and Australis means southern.
Yeah, of course. So Occident or Occidental also gets used to mean white, and we have the Occidental Observer. Well, let's get into a recap then from last week. Last week, we heard how the team were dealt a crushing blow when they discovered that Amundsen and the Norwegians had got to the pole first. By not distracting themselves with scientific experiments to carry out for their financial backers, and by just concentrating on the one task at hand, the secretive Scandinavian had broken the record and was the first to stake a claim to the furthest point south. At this point, Scott's team must have wondered whether it may have been safer to simply turn back, but they were determined that even if they were not to be the first, they would still plant the flag of the Empire on that most furthest south spot. Due to the poor quality of the ponies, the loss and failure of the motor sledges, and the lack of trained huskies, they were man-hauling the sledges and were already suffering from frostbite before they even saw the signs of Amundsen having got there first. At the pole itself, they built a cairn and planted their, quote, poor, slighted Union Jacks, which I found quite emotional to read. The whole expedition itself was infused with patriotism, and it was that flame which had kept them fired up to complete this stupendous feat of endurance from the start. The return trip must have been hell for them, as it dawned on them that their chances of surviving were dropping by the hour. Yet even as they reduced their rations, they retained their good spirits in their conversation, despite Evans breaking down first in mind and then body before being the first to go. Oates got worse next, with his frostbite turning to gangrene, and the doctor handed out morphine pills to each of them, enough to take their own lives, but none of them did. Oates then walked out of the tent to his doom, uttering the famous quote, "I am just going outside and maybe some time," before never being seen alive again. And I did have difficulty reading the notes last week. We had to make quite a few takes of it because I was getting quite emotional So I will try my best to get through it this week. Is there any comments you want to make on my recap there, Max, or anything else to do with the series?
I think that's a pretty accurate recap. I think the thing that this story tells us, one of the key learning points from all of this is that when we look at the kind of exploits that people tend to do in the modern day, and I'm thinking here of a motley sort of variety of celebrities being invited to partake in "I'm a celebrity, get me out of here." The suffering and the determination and the endurance of the people who went with Scott to the South Pole is in a different universe compared to the sort of people who participate in "I'm a celebrity, get me out of here." And people may marvel at the ability of somebody to stuff a kangaroo's penis down their throat, but even something as revolting as that pales into utter insignificance in comparison with continuing to march on with gangrene setting in your feet. And these people that were accompanied Scott, and Scott himself, were mighty men of a type that really deserve to be role models, that really deserve to our admiration, and not just pampered celebrities who are going without for a few days.
Oh, definitely. I mean, these are the people that we should be looking up to. I mean, it's it's such a shame that people hero worship these modern day celebrities and TV stars when we have these absolute giants like in our bloodline from our past that we really should be looking up to. Well, on March the 20th, they awoke in the tent to a raging blizzard. Scott's right foot had become a problem, and he knew that these are the steps of my downfall. Amputation was a certainty, but will the trouble spread? That is the serious question. They were only 11 miles from One Ton Depot, but the blizzard stopped them from continuing on. They were all out of oil and had only 2 days' worth of rations. Have decided it shall be natural. We shall march for the depot and die in our tracks, wrote Scott. But they did not march again, and on March the 29th, Scott made his last entry. It seems a pity, but I do not think I can write more. Ah, Scott, for God's sake, look after our people. And I think we can see there that all of this has been done for the British people. It's been done for the honour and the glory of the British Empire, and particularly for the English people. I mean, he's talking about the people there. He's talking about his extended family more so than the country. It's the last thing that he writes. For God's sake, look after our people. So who is that directed to? It's directed to the nation, to look after itself, and to our leaders to look after us. And that's why he was doing this. On another page, he scribbled, "Send this diary to my widow." Remarkably, Scott was able to find the strength, despite being half-starved and three-quarters frozen, to write 12 complete legible letters. He wrote to Kathleen and Hannah, to his brother-in-law, to his naval comrades, Sir Francis Bridgman and Sir George Egerton, to the Reginald Smiths and to Sir James Barry. And to Barry he wrote, "I may not have proved a great explorer, but we have done the greatest march ever made and come very near to great success." And he makes a really good point that. And that's why, you know, we need to honour people like him and talk about what he did and remind people of what he did and bring the story of this to people who have never heard it before, because it was absolutely incredible to be walking, dragging those sledges, dragging the weight of a man all the way through that snow along and up glaciers in order to get to the South Pole, in order just to be the first people to get there. And even in the face of knowing that they had that it was going to be certain doom, they still went there and they still planted the British flag and then made their way back. He wrote to Oates and Bower's mothers and also to Wilson's wife. Interesting there, paying respects to his to the other expedition members that were there, and writing to their mothers. And I should imagine he was probably sort of apologizing for leading them on this mission. I mean, it shows a lot of concern there, doesn't it, for his men?
It's in the same way that officers used to write letters back to the wives and mothers of men who died in the trenches during the First World War and the Second World War.
Wilson wrote to his parents, "Looking forward to the day when we shall all meet together in the hereafter. I have had a very happy life, and I look forward to a very happy life hereafter when we shall all be together again. God knows I have no fear of meeting him, for he will be merciful to all of us. My poor Ori may or may not have long to wait." Letters were written to J.J. Kinsey in New Zealand and Sir Edgar Speyer, expressing regrets for leaving the expedition in such a state of affairs. "But we have been to the pole, and we shall die like gentlemen." And that was the point of it. They knew that it was certain doom, but they had actually achieved the mission. They still continued on right until the very last. And they were not just dying like gentlemen, but dying like absolute heroes, and the best example that could ever be given to the nation back home. In Scott's letter to Kathleen, he wrote of hopes for his son. "I had looked forward to helping you to bring him up, but it is a satisfaction to know that he will be safe with you. Make the boy interested in natural history if you can. It is better than games. They encourage it in some schools. I know you will keep him in the open air. Try to make him believe in a God. It is comforting. And guard him against indolence. Make him a strenuous man. I had to force myself into being strenuous, as you know. I always had an inclination to be idle." So good advice there, and giving us some insight into himself that and everybody else. You know, people don't find things easy. You have to work hard at anything that is going to actually be worth anything, that has some value. You have to work hard for.
Yeah. If something's easy, everybody will do it, and it has no value. There's only value in doing things that are difficult.
"As for Kathleen, I want you to take the whole thing very sensibly, as I am sure you will. You know I cherish no sentimental rubbish about remarriage. When the right man comes to help you in life, you ought to be your happy self again. I wasn't a very good husband, but I hope I shall be a good memory. The inevitable must be faced. You urged me to be the leader of this party, and I know you felt it would be dangerous. I have taken my place throughout, haven't I? What lots and lots I could tell you of this journey. How much better it has been than lounging about in too great comfort at home. What tales you would have had for the boy. But oh, what a price to pay. Dear, you will be good to the old mother. I haven't had time to write to Sir Clements. Tell him I thought much of him and never regretted his putting me in charge of the discovery." I mean, he's loyal right to the very end. He's spending yes. the last hours of his life trying to write as many letters as he can to the people that he feels the loyalty to. I mean, it's just incredible how honourable this man was, and pointing out that, you know, about not wanting to be lounging around in too great a comfort at home.
That's right. And also advice for Kathleen as to how she should conduct herself throughout the rest of her life. You know, all that is very touching, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's extremely moving. Finally, there was a message to the public. He explained how the expedition's disaster was not due to poor planning, but by bad weather and bad luck. It was no one's fault. "But for my own sake, I do not regret this journey, which has shown that Englishmen can endure hardships, help one another, and meet death with as great a fortitude as ever in the past. We took risks. We knew we took them. Things have come out against us, and therefore we have no cause for complaint, but bow to the will of Providence, determined still to do our best to the last. Had we lived, I should have had a tale to tell of the hardihood, endurance, and courage of my companions, which would have stirred the heart of every Englishman. These rough notes and our dead bodies must tell the tale, but surely, surely a great, rich country like ours will see that those who are dependent on us are properly provided for. Again, you can see the ethnocentrism here and the loyalty to his people and the point of doing this to show that it could be done. If there is something out there, then men will try to do that. If there's anything that we can achieve for the first time, then we will achieve it. You know, we will go into space, we will go to the bottom of the ocean, we will go to the South Pole, we will go to the North Pole.
The striving to do things better, the striving to go further, to go faster, striving in every possible respect, that is a key feature of our people, isn't it?
It is, and that's why he was showing it here. Englishmen, I mean, it's a particular English thing to do this. That's why the English were the first to do so many things. And to think he's writing all these letters to the people that he's close to, and then also this letter to the public, because he wants this journey to be an example. He wants it to be remembered, and he wants Englishmen to try and live up to the standards that he set, basically. Even at the very end, Scott still felt comfortable with his decisions and felt a need to defend that position when he wrote, "Every detail of our food supplies, clothing and depots worked out to perfection. We have missed getting through by a narrow margin, which was justifiably within the risk of such a journey." And they did, you know, it was only very narrowly that they didn't have enough oil when they got to the depots, and the dogs weren't there at that depot. And it was literally only 2 days' walk to the next one or something like that. It was just so near and yet so far. Death to Scott was not a failure because they had reached their goal, the pole. He hoped he had set an example of courage and loyalty to all those left behind when he wrote to Sir Francis Bridgman, "After all, we are setting a good example to our countrymen, if not by getting into a tight place, by facing it like men when we were there." So that was the whole point of this, was to set up the myth, the legend around him, and this incredible achievement of endurance that they went through. The blizzard raged on for another 10 days before Scott's last entry on March the 29th, 1912. It was not until November the 12th that Surgeon Atkinson, leader of the search party, found their tent all but buried in snow. When Silas Wright pulled the flap aside, they saw the three men in their sleeping bags. On the left was Wilson, his hands crossed on his chest. On the right, Bowers, wrapped in his bag. It appeared that both had died peacefully in their sleep. But Scott was lying half out of his bag with one arm stretched towards Wilson. Trigvi Gran said it was a horrid sight. It was clear he had had a very hard last minutes. His skin was yellow and frostbitten all over. Gran envied them. They died having done something great. How hard must not death be, having done nothing? Petty Officer Williamson said his face was very pinched and his hands, I should say, had been terribly frostbitten. Never again in my life do I want to behold the sight we have just seen. At the age of 43, Scott had been the last to die. So he must have kept himself alive until the others had, you know, just by sheer willpower, wanting to be the last man on the ship as it went down. Atkinson took charge of the diaries and letters and read aloud the account of Oates' death and the message to the public. He then read the burial service and a chapter from Corinthians, after which all the men gathered and sang Scott's favourite hymn, Onwards, Christian Soldiers. The tent was then collapsed over the bodies and a snow cairn was built over all. Placed on top was a pair of crossed skis. Here they would lie until one day, drifting with the barrier, they would find their final resting place in the sea. Atkinson led the search party back along the path believed taken by Scott in the hopes of finding Oates. They found his sleeping bag, but nothing more. Near the spot where they assumed he had fallen, the men erected a cross with the following inscription. Hereabouts died a very gallant gentleman, Captain L.E.G. Oates of the Inniskilling Dragoons. In March 1912, returning from the pole, he walked willingly to his death in a blizzard to try to save his comrades, beset by hardship. The expedition itself was expected back in New Zealand early in April 1913. In January, Kathleen set out to meet him by way of the United States. After a few days of camping with cowboys in New Mexico, she set out from San Francisco aboard the RMS Orangi. On February 19th, between Tahiti and Rarotonga, she was called to the captain's cabin. With shaking hands, he showed her a message received by wireless. Captain Scott and six others perished in a blizzard after reaching the South Pole on January the 18th. She went into mental shock as she went about her business the rest of the day, playing cards, taking a Spanish lesson, and discussing American politics. Her brother Wilfred met her in Wellington along with Ori Wilson, Atkinson and Teddy Evans, who had taken the Terra Nova down to McMurdo Sound to embark Scott's party and the rest of the expedition. Atkinson handed Kathleen her husband's diary and his last letter. It was now Kathleen's turn to be courageous, in the face of tremendous debt still owed from the expedition. Ironically, with the death of the leader came funding that retired the £30,000 debt. But before long, £75,509 had come in, which paid all outstanding debt and allowed grants to all dependents. There was still £12,000 remaining, and this was handed over to Cambridge University, which used the gift towards the foundation of the Scott Polar Research Institute, which is still there today. Officially constituted in 1926, Frank Debenham became the first director. The honour that would have been bestowed upon Scott was awarded to his wife Kathleen. She became Lady Scott. Kathleen continued to carve statues of many leaders of her day, kings, prime ministers, writers and adventurers, including Nansen, who wanted her to marry him. She rejected the proposal but kept him as a friend. Kathleen went on to marry Edward Hilton Young, a politician who later became Lord Kennet of the Dean, and she died of leukemia in 1947. Other than Kathleen and the family, no one grieved more than Sir Clements Markham. He was now 83 and plagued by gout. The electric light bulb was widely used by now, but Markham still preferred to read by candlelight. One night, while reading in bed, the bedclothes caught fire. The butler rushed in and extinguished the flames, but the shock was too great, and the old man died unconscious in January 1916. So that sort of rounds up the whole story there, but it's just so moving to actually read that, and hopefully I'll be able to edit that, but I had real difficulty doing that. I just want to let the listeners know. And just to finish up here, to find out what actually happened to them, back at Cape Evans, the Terra Nova arrived at the beginning of February, and Atkinson decided to unload the supplies from the ship with his own men rather than set out south with the dogs to meet Scott as he had been ordered. when Atkinson finally did leave south for the planned rendezvous with Scott, he encountered the scurvy-ridden Edward Teddy Evans, who needed urgent medical attention. Atkinson therefore tried to send the experienced navigator Wright south to meet Scott, but Chief Meteorologist Simpson declared that he needed Wright for scientific work. Atkinson then decided to send the short-sighted Cherry Garrard on the 25th of February, who was not able to navigate. He only got as far as the one-ton depot, which is within sight of Mount Erebus, effectively cancelling Scott's orders for meeting him at latitude 82 or 82.30 on the 1st of March. And I think this really shows the reason why this trip failed. There was too much concentration on the scientific work. Amundsen was just single-minded and he just went for the South Pole, whereas Scott, being such a generous and charitable man, he said to all these backers, well, we'll do this other work for you while we are there. And then you've got these guys here who are wanting to do the scientific work when they really needed to go out there and check that the expedition was safe. And just as another piece of evidence for this, and I got this from another report of this, when they discovered the bodies, next to their bodies lay 35 pounds or 16 kilos of Glossopteris tree fossils, which they had been dragging around on hand sledges. And these were the first ever discovered Antarctic fossils, and they proved that Antarctica had once been warm and connected to other continents. But this shows you how dedicated they were. I mean, they were dragging all of this by hand, and they were dragging rocks around with them to try and please these scientists that had all been saying to them, oh yes, well, while you're out there, can you just do this? And can you just do that? And do you mind doing this? And do you mind checking that? And they wanted to bring these fossils back to show everybody what they had discovered. He tried to give away more than it was possible for a man to give, and that was really the reason why this failed. He was just trying to do too much. I think it's all too much for one man. But yeah, very very moving, and I guess we. Could something like that happen again today?
Well, I was thinking as we were, as you were reading through those notes, that and following the comments that I made about, you know, comparing what Scott did with I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and the point I'd like to make to our listeners basically is that the genes of these people still live on in our population. And there are still people who are able to doggedly and determinedly perform feats of endurance and to use the sort of televised phrase, to boldly go where no man has gone before. Because, you know, there are still modern day explorers that do similar things, that go to the South Pole, that go to the North Pole. We've done as one of our greatest Britons, Ranulph Fiennes. And, you know, Ranulph Fiennes suffered many of the same privations that Scott and his team did, in terms of getting gangrene in his feet and gangrene in his fingers. And I don't know whether you recall, we spoke about how Ranulph Fiennes at one point thought he was going to get gangrene in his hands because he'd got gangrene in his fingertips. And so he took an electric fret saw and cut the tops off of his fingers so that the gangrene wouldn't spread to his hand. And we were marveling at, you know, how strong-willed somebody would have to be able to take that very radical step in order to save their life, and so that they could then continue with their expedition, etc. And there are men like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos who are using the vast wealth that they've accumulated today to sponsor scientific expeditions for humans to go further than humans have ever gone before. And, you know, there was a space flight recently with Bezos. What's the actor's name that played
Captain Kirk? William Shatner.
Yeah, William Shatner, that's right, where William Shatner went out into outer space in one of Jeff Bezos' craft, and there was criticism of it afterwards that it was squandering the resources of the planet. But in fact, the opposite really is true, because it's people like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk that are pushing forward the frontiers in the same way that Scott did. They're not personally themselves putting themselves under so much stress and in so much danger as Scott is, but they're providing the money to enable other people to begin space exploration. And I firmly believe that space exploration and us reaching other planets and being able to start to colonize other planets is the key to the future of humanity, and it's something that we should put a lot of our resources behind, and we should respect the people that are trying to achieve that.
Well, I guess really that's not that different to back then, is it? I mean, we were talking about how they had to get backers and sponsors for this expedition to the South Pole, and here we are today. And again, you've got backers and sponsors in order to get people into space instead of NASA doing it. So things really haven't changed that much over the last 100 years. And you bring up Sir Ranulph Fiennes there with his fingers with frostbite. I mean, it was Scott's foot, and that's why they had surgeons with them, so that they could chop people's limbs off if necessary when they got gangrene and when they got frostbite. I mean, it's just incredible conditions. And as you were pointing out to me last week, after we finished the podcast, Max, you know, you were pointing out how Prince Harry talks about his mental health and what a stress it is. I mean, you imagine the mental anguish that these men went through and the barriers that they broke down to do what they did. And we've all got that within us, you know.
And the mental strength to face all of that, that's right.
And we're descended from the same extended family. We're all capable of doing these sorts of things. You know, they talk on the television, oh, if you have a dream, you can achieve it. And usually you hear the ethnic minorities saying that. Well, looking at something like this, we can say, well, our ancestors did achieve the incredible. And we should be pushing ourselves to be the best people that we can be, and following Captain Scott's example, because that's why he set that example. So that we could look to him and try to be just a fraction of what he was, and then you know we would be much better people. Just being a fraction of what Captain Scott was, then you've led a productive life, I think. Well, I think we should leave it there then for today, Max. So thank you very much for coming on today.
Thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure, and I wish all of our listeners a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back in the new year with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you, and a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.